welcome to the podcast, Agroecology World. Once again, this is your host, Rob Clusen, a.k.a. Dr. K. And yes, I'm still on my world travels with my wife, Skye. This podcast is the first of two to introduce you to a couple meetings with outstanding practitioners and communities of agroecology in the fascinating country of New Zealand. We will learn how the science of agroecology is used for developing the design and best practices of sustainable agriculture and community food systems in New Zealand. And as always, my intent for this podcast is to introduce you to actual folks and places so that you can learn from their ideas and experiences, keeping it informal but informative and light but enlightening. In this episode, we're going to continue our exploration of the scope of agroecology. Agroecology focuses on the knowledge and implementation of the three pillars of the social, environmental, and economic basis of sustainability for agriculture and food systems. If you haven't listened to it already, you may want to check out my episode 3 to hear some more attributes of the science of agroecology. Now, before jumping into this episode, I thought you would appreciate getting some more background information about agroecology by explaining another one of its components. For example, take the approach of environmental agroecology. For starters, environmental agroecology focuses on the idea that farms are agroecosystems, which is based on the ecosystem concept from the science of ecology. An ecosystem can be defined as the interaction of living and non-living components that produce a dynamic, self-organizing, and regenerative natural system. For example, a forest or a lake. Critical attributes of ecosystems include the presence of emergent properties, that is, when the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and the presence of various scales of its functionality. For example, spatial, temporal, hierarchical. Yes, the unifying concept of agroecology is the idea that farms should mimic the functioning of local ecosystems that provide the productivity necessary for sustainable yields in the long run. It's contrasted with industrial agriculture, which emphasizes maximum production at the cost of lost productivity. Example themes of environmental agroecology can include enhancing biodiversity, complex structure and function, nutrient cycling, soil food webs, and resiliency. My episodes of Agroecology World will hopefully feature practitioners of many of these topics. Authors such as Miguel Altieri have researched and written about the value and best practices for promoting biodiversity as a tool for sustainable agroecosystems. For example, farmscaping for pollinators and biological controls, composting for soil life and earthworms, and wildlife conservation. Equally important is focusing on biodiversity issues both on-site and off-site of the farm. Habitats for biodiversity can require a scale larger than one farm, and off-site impacts of farming can be detrimental to local wildlife. Today's episode introduces you to a program of sustainable agriculture in Aotearoa, which is the indigenous Maori name for the country of New Zealand. The literal translation of Aotearoa is Land of the Long White Cloud. This episode is focused on an annual seminar called Farming for the Future for local farmers and community food systems that will be held on March 27th of this year, 2019. Just to give you a little more background to it, I found out about this event and the organizers when my wife showed me their advertisement in the local newspaper, the Wairarapa Times-Age. What really drew my attention to it were the titles of the organizers, the South Wairarapa Biodiversity Group, and the Mangatera Restoration Society, as well as their mission statement of helping farmers, businesses, and organizations improve their knowledge and understanding of the natural environment, reduce their environmental footprint, and achieve more sustainable outcomes. After perusing the seminar agenda, I especially liked the diversity of the speakers, which range from the CEO of Stonyfield Farms in the USA, to a local organic goat dairy cheese farmer, to a clean waters advocate, to a New Zealand agriculture greenhouse gas researcher. I was impressed that here is a program that embraces the scope of agroecology of promoting sustainability through sustainable agriculture and community food systems. I knew that I wanted to bring them to the attention of you, the listeners of Agroecology World. After a short musical interlude, we will listen to a conversation that I had with one of the core stakeholders of this seminar program, Heather Atkinson, from my travels northeast of the capital Wellington in the Wairarapa River watershed on the North Island of New Zealand in early February of 2019. Hello, hello. This is your host of the podcast Agroecology World, Rob Klussen, a.k.a. Dr. K. And today, I am in the lovely country of New Zealand in the greater Wellington region. Wellington is our capital, if you're not that familiar with New Zealand. And I'm in the northeast area of this region, in a lovely rural area in district of Carterton right now. And while here, I read in the local newspaper of a very interesting workshop coming in March of 2019 called Farming for the Future. And it's an event that is put together by a coalition of community groups that are looking at increasing biodiversity on farms and ranches, as well as environmental protection and conservation. And I was lucky enough to meet one of the stakeholders for this event, Heather Atkinson, and I'm with her today at her beautiful home in the town of Carterton, near at the foothills of a mountain range. I don't know the name of it, but it's a lovely sight, and I've just had a quick tour of her grounds, just beautiful native plants, orchards, raised bed, edible crops. And we're here to talk with her about the workshop, but also in general on how this community is working together to promote sustainability in agriculture as well as in the whole local economy, because that's really what I read about the description of the workshop. So right now I'm going to introduce Heather and ask her to give us a little bit of the background of the workshop and the groups that she's associated with, and get us started on knowing a little bit more about their goals and kind of the overall vision that they're hoping to bring for their community.
Hi, lovely to meet you, Rob. You're Heather Atkinson. I'm actually a nurse by training, but I'm a farmer by profession. So we've got a farm in the South Wairarapa that's been certified organic for 25 plus years, and that's sort of my perspective. So I've got a health and agriculture background. And in terms of our seminar, Farming for the Future, it's in its sixth or seventh year this year. It had its birthplace in a local group that we started back in 2010. And we were farming in the South Wairarapa and had a real vision to try and improve the understanding and the knowledge of farmers around the essentialness of having biodiversity on farm and better environmental management. And so we started a group back then, which became incorporated and has been functioning for a number of years. And the Farming for the Future was really came out of that, because one of our objectives way back in those early days was to improve farming practices through support and education. And we realised quite quickly that while we were doing a lot of work around managing to put more biodiversity into our local environment. We didn't really have a vehicle to talk with farmers. We were mostly capturing other people in the community that might have been interested in planting or looking after our river or that, but we weren't really engaging with farmers that effectively. So wanting to sort of meet all our objectives, we thought, well, maybe we need to create a vehicle to do that. So we had our first one in Martinborough and we had about 80 attendees, and we've grown from there really in lots of ways. So
all right. Yeah, I know it's sometimes a very slow process to present and have adopted new ideas to the community, agriculture as well as non-agriculture. So, well, Heather, kind of curious on sort of how, a little bit more about how the group has been able to get together where you are now. So, internally, I know you have a coalition of groups, and there's a skill set that your partners bring to it, which give you the ability to do certain things. So maybe a little bit about, I know New Zealand is very much like Australia, the home of permaculture ideas, and biodiversity goes hand in hand with that. And then again, in the community at large, because one of the things that intrigued me was the diversity of stakeholders that the workshop is intended for. It's not just farmers and ranchers. And that is really intriguing to me. Your feelings of what's the community asking for to help you actually develop a community food system in the broadest sense of the word?
Okay, that sounds like quite a bit to answer, but let's start at the beginning. So how did the seminar evolve out of that group?
Core values.
Sure. So it from having that objective that was unmet, we were approached by a local business, actually, that had seen the work that we were doing, saw that we had a vision for our group, a set of objectives, a strategy, and that appealed to them. They were looking for a group to partner in terms of something that was consistent with their values. They work in the resource management area, and they were looking to partner with a group and approached us about sponsoring, really. What were the deficits we had? What did we need as a group that would enable us to move forward? And being practical people, we were more hands-on, so support with managing membership and administration, newsletters and the like was where they then dug in and started supporting us. So that was years and years ago. Out of that came a conversation around those objectives and engaging with farmers that felt really dire and essential. You've got lots of pressures that will be familiar to you, and our community is no different. And so I had a conversation with one of the stakeholders in that business, and we talked about perhaps creating, getting some expertise in and creating a vehicle to have some conversations about better environmental management, about going for profit, not production per se, about building more resilience, about managing risk in doing so, just around how we can still be farming, but we can be working in a more resilient way and building in more biodiversity and making sure that we're not damaging the environment in the process. So we started with the little one locally, and we did it really our group with this business partner initially, but it soon became bigger than that, which was pretty exciting. And now we have a mix of partners that come together every year to plan the seminar, and we start about 6 months out, and our core group is somebody from that business. And myself, I've led the event for the duration. And then we've actually partnered up with another community group. So what I think's exciting about this seminar is it's not We see a lot of workshops and seminars coming out of industry groups, or perhaps could be fertilizer companies, could be educational institutions, could be a number of conduits like that. And we are definitely, the driver for this came out of community. So it was about the community deciding what the content was and what they wanted to hear. And I think the benefit that we have in that is that we don't have any, we don't have a prescriptive set of rules that we have to adhere to, and we can choose the content and we have ownership of that, and we don't, we're not going to offend anyone in our industry group, and we're not going to get direction from them. So it's up to the people on the team to decide where we want to head in terms of content. And we deliberately try to be a little bit provocative, to stretch boundaries, to stretch people's thinking, to model, show innovation, to build, show them models of resilience, and more sustainable models, and demystify maybe some of that, and definitely solutions focused. So give them a chance to talk to people that have been successful, or to hear about what they've done and what they can take home for themselves. So we see it as being a driver for change on farm or in industry.
And I've noticed the roster of speakers you have for this year's seminar also exemplifies that diversity, from business to practical best practices on a farm to climate change research. It really, like you say, trying to open up some doors to people to see more of a bigger picture than maybe they're accustomed to hearing about.
Yeah, and one of the things, we had a conversation before this started, we were talking about farmers really relating to farmers, and that they're often their best teachers because they respect the farmer's journey. So one thing that we learnt really early on is that it's really important that we have a regional, somebody regionally that farmers can identify with. So we always have somebody in the region that's doing something very cool that is part of our lineup. So this year we do have the Drunken Nanny, and that's a sheep and beef farm originally that's diversified into milking goats, and they have a whole range of fantastic products. So really important that we keep, there's a relatability there for our local farmers, that there's somebody in their community that's doing something so that they can identify with. And then last year our theme was climate change, so we're just trying to draw some threads through from last year and having that component. And it's huge on our horizons, massive driver for change. And this year we're very, very excited to have Gary Hirschberg of Stonyfield Farms in, from the USA, coming out. So I've known Gary for a little while, and I know he's keen to promote, or sees an opportunity perhaps for New Zealand to do things differently because of our isolation. It can be a problem for us, but it also could be a real opportunity that he's keen to promote and share with us some of his experience and some of his understanding of the markets as well. So a first for us to have an international speaker, but we're very excited about the content, but very essential we have local content as well. Yeah.
Well, that also was something that I had a question about when I read a little bit about the background of the biodiversity group. It mentioned a lot about wetlands. And that made me think, when you say biodiversity, yes, there's biodiversity on the farm, but now you're also bringing biodiversity off the farm. For you or and your group, how did that journey get started? Did it really start with, okay, our wetlands are being impacted, let's try to understand this more, and then that kind of led you to the farms, or was it a bit of both?
So it started actually with a couple of frustrated farming women, and we were talking about the lack of progress and movement in our community around looking after our wetlands specifically. So in the south, we are at the bottom end of this catchment, and so we are the the river that flows right through the Wairarapa, the Rumahanga, is it goes out to sea in our catch in our district. So we're very mindful that we're the sum total of all the ingredients that get put into that river. We used to call it the arse end of the river, but it is, we are the sum total. Everything that impacts all the way through the Wairarapa to our awa in the South Wairarapa, we see it all there, and it's really important that we show some leadership that we hope would translate upstream. And we're also aware that it's quite a public area down in the South Wairarapa. There's a lot of tourists come over, and we thought it would be a great place to showcase some really good management around waterways. We've got the river that flows into a lake just by the sea. We've also got a lagoon that is that has been formed when the area was modified. So we started off with a project working along the edge of our lake to try and build some more habitat for our inanga, because there's quite an inanga spawning area, so that's the white bait that is all along our river system in the bottom end there. And so we thought it was really important to soften that edge of the lake, provide some habitat for and biodiversity ultimately. And then we got involved with bigger projects and partnered with the district council, and they had a grey water reticulation system for the community that lived down there, and they had a wetland area, so we partnered with them and the regional council to create a wetland. So definitely for us, partnerships has been key. We've never worked in isolation as a group, and we've always bought in other partners like our regional council, our district councils, Department of Conservation, more recently other groups, and certainly the community. We've always worked to try and leverage the resources of all those people and get buy-in from our community to progress the initiative. So a focus for us in terms of water has been in the bottom of the catchment there, because we have that, the lake, the river, the sea, and this lagoon, and we've been working for probably 8 years and investing in planting, building awareness. We see it as a real great way to educate our community about good guardianship, and also our neighbours from over the hill from Wellington, because it's lots of recreational use of water and land down our way.
Actually, some of what you're describing reminds me of another organisation that I'm familiar with. They're called the Nature Conservancy, and they very much approach it the way your group is approaching it, that there's more benefits than just the farmer or rancher for all this work. There's tourism businesses, mm-hmm. there's other enterprises and the local food economy. I know this is a big wine, grape growing area too, in addition to cattle and sheep, and so all that. Like you say, you have this relatively affluent population in Wellington that can come out and have a grand time in the country, and that benefits the entire community. Well, let's flip the coin a little bit, in that it's not uncommon for these kinds of organizations and projects to hit a stumbling block or a wall and have to figure out how to get around it to achieve their goal or their vision. And maybe, you know, you don't have to inventory all of them, but maybe some of the ones that come to mind. Okay, and what I'm thinking of here is as your group matured, or as it's going along, those kinds of skill sets that you guys figured out you needed to add to the core group that started things to bring you, to give you more capacity. And then the really big $60,000 question is those threats or challenges out there that still are not allowing this message to get as received and implemented as quickly as we all know they should. But nevertheless, It's not that it's stopping you. It's just that you're trying to figure out how to address it and work your way around it so that the message could keep being put out there to more and more people.
Okay, so I'm going to discuss this in the context of the Farming for the Future team. Is that good?
Yeah, that's
so
great.
So let's talk about that team because that's a really cross-section of people, and so it's constituted of representatives from our South Waipa Biodiversity Group, which was the birth, which sort of birthed this project. Also another more northern group in the Carterton area called the Mangatariri Restoration Society. Also that resource management business, which is perception planning. And we've had for another one is our regional council have one of their managers there is on that group. So in terms of membership, that's who it is. We've had other people come and go, and our core, we've always had a core of people, and I guess we've got core drivers. I think that is really fundamental. So the team that we have are absolutely vested in this event, and everyone has ownership for it. Everyone is highly accountable for the outcomes and the deliverables that we have to have. There's a huge sense of responsibility for self that I guess it's one of the easiest groups. I do some other work with teams and with some of my other hats, but in terms of the team that organise this event, they're a fantastic team, and I think that's a huge thing when you're trying to get things happening, is build a good team. Think about, know what your aim is, know where you're heading, and collect people that buy into that vision. Yeah, I really stress having some sort of strategic overview, have some sense of the big picture and ownership about that, and communicate it and share it. And people tend to gravitate to that, and we always find what we need. It's really, really interesting. I never have to ask this team to do something. We often have a discussion, say, somebody, you know, we need to get this happening. Well, always somebody puts their hand up, such as the absolute buy-in from the group. It's the easiest group I've ever had anything to do with working with, and I think it all comes down to a sense of strategy, a sense of vision. We know what we want to do. We know we can deliver it. What I love is that it's two community groups fundamentally that run the seminar with support from fantastic other groups, but it's community-led. And I love that we can turn on a highly professional, well-considered, credible event from two community groups. Everyone imagines that it's led by one of the industry groups, but no, it's a couple of community groups. So I love that we can bring an air of professionalism, credibility, value, and we're starting to meet the needs of, you know, the community, the primary. We've got a massive primary sector community here. A lot of it's sheep and beef and dairy. We've also got, as you said, the viticulture's massive here. We have some horticulture, and we're really trying to, with this team, is pull together something that has an appeal, has value for all of those sectors.
And that's really the strength that I see. Just my first impression, to tell you the truth, because I don't usually see seminars or workshops targeting such a diverse audience as you guys do, and that's just so great to see.
I guess we have an opportunity here because this region, as you've expressed earlier, we're very close to Wellington. It's an hour and a half to Wellington, and sitting in Wellington is our government, all our policy writers. We've got lots of people that we want to influence, and it's relatively easy for them to get here. So we do. We love to talk. We've also got a lot of the industry groups, Dairy NZ, Federated Farmers, Beef and Lamb New Zealand, Hort NZ, a lot of them are based out of Wellington. So there's a real opportunity, as well as getting the people on the ground here, the horticulturalists, the farmers, the farm consultants, the agribusiness groups, the bankers, the accountants, as well as getting them along, we've also got this community over the hill in Wellington that we love to influence. And so it is a really broad cross-section of people that we get, and it's really exciting.
Mm. That's great, yeah. Well, you mentioned something that was basically a huge challenge for my work back in Florida was the policies, both at the local level and the state level, that are restricting a lot of these ideas, which have to be addressed, and you have to learn how to play the game of policy making, it's not the easiest thing to do, but at the same time, it's something that I always encourage groups to think about that. In fact, we have a strong movement back in the States, about other countries too. They call them food policy councils, and it's more than, well, food in the broadest definition, you know. And it's more about the food economy, really, and all the different processes as well as players that could be part of that kind of economy. And so I'm glad you mentioned that. And now a couple things that before we wrap up, I did read that your pilot project, I wanted to tie it back with some of the biodiversity initiatives, your pilot project with dung beetles. How is that going on your ranch?
That's a great story. So we were once they got permission to bring dung beetles back in.
Okay.
Right, so I'm not sure how much you know about the background of the dung beetle, but New Zealand does have its own native dung beetle, but it lives in the forest, so it's not beneficial to our pastures or as a tool to mitigate animal dung at all. So when we bought domestic animals to New Zealand, we never bought the dung beetle with them, which was unique to us. I think in most cases they did travel, or they did come out at the same time. So we've got a huge number of livestock here, and we never had the dung beetle as a resource to mitigate some of the damage from that. So way back in the beginning, as you suggested, it's probably some 5 years ago, we were the first property in New Zealand to receive the first batch of dung beetles outside of Northland. There was a pilot that was running up there, and we released them to much fanfare, and we had TV there, and it was all terribly exciting. And we released them on our deer block, and that was pretty cool. I'm not sure about how that's evolved, but I know there's private interest now that are managing some of this, and they've become commercially available. At that stage, they weren't. And our regional council have led a charge to get them more established in the area, and to that end, they were subsidising the purchase of dung beetles around our big lake Wairarapa, so our Wairarapa Moana. And we luckily fell on the outskirts of that, so we were invited to get some more dung beetles in the last fortnight, in fact. So I was down babysitting at the farm with my little grandson, and the mailman came in with two plastic crates full of beetles just in the last fortnight. So they're certainly introducing some more species, because I think to carry the different you have different dung beetles for different seasons, I understand. So to get good coverage in terms of getting the dung down from the top of the pastures and integrated into the soil, you need to have a number of species. And I often get asked, how are the dung beetles going? And in the beginning, we only got 300 dung beetles on a 600-acre property. And so I likened it to pouring a cup of salt on a sandy beach for a start. It takes some while before you can see the effect. But certainly they did some monitoring a couple of years ago and found evidence of dung beetles. So we then moved and had a cluster of groups around our farm that then a cluster of farms around our property, that then release some, and then this more recent one will establish them further, we hope, in the district. So it's moving along positively, and it's certainly broadened in terms of the area that's got beetles now. So we're hoping that they'll be a really useful tool.
Yeah, and as you know, I mean, there's just layers and layers of benefits to that. You start controlling the parasites of your livestock, as well as then you start seeing your soil organic matter increasing, and that's just one piece of the soil biodiversity. And when you start thinking about all of the other components of the soil biodiversity that could be introduced if needed, then it just opens up so many ideas of how you could then start modifying, if not changing, the entire management system of your farm and ranch, when you can tap into that ecological service that we like to call them, you know. Because I mean, you're also, from what I've heard you say, you're looking at the landscape benefits. Some of those are not even on the farm. And so, but yet it's a positive feedback loop, because in other projects I've read that are attempting similar things, well, that then restores maybe some of the natural hydrology that has disappeared from the farms and ranches. And so you never know exactly how it's going to work out, but there are lots of positive reports of such approaches that as if you benefit not only your immediate homestead or farm, that more often than not the benefits will come back to help you too. Yeah,
I think one of the key things with the dung beetle project, when I reflect on it, was that because we were doing it, we then had a meeting with our neighbours about what we were doing, and we got the specialist down to talk to everyone and demystify it a little bit. And I guess for us as certified organic farmers, it was a way that we could engage with our neighbours in a very, that had some positive benefits from them and no perceived risk. We had the backing of our regional council and these industry experts. And it was a really positive thing in terms of, I think you've got to build a sense of community around these projects and get that buy-in. And it was perceived as a safe thing to do. And I often think that going back to the biodiversity group and the work that we've done around the lake there, just to digress, is I remember really clearly there was a lot of resistance to our first suggested planting along the lake. People were concerned about views and access and lots of things, and people, there was even talk of sabotage in the early stages. And I remember doing a beach clean a couple of years later, and I happened to know who these people were, and they were I overheard them talking to some other people on the day, and they were telling them about how cool it was that they'd managed to get this planted and what a difference it had made to the whole appearance of the lake and what a good thing it was for improving the margin, and really owned it. So I think the lesson there is that actually sometimes your harshest critics can be the biggest champions. And I that was really powerful for me, to think that some of the people that had really struggled with what we were trying to achieve absolutely were there championing the whole project to other people, you know, some years down the track.
What a beautiful way to end our conversation. Yeah. No, I concur wholeheartedly. Don't give up. And so, thanks so much, Heather. This has been a wonderful time spending with you and learning more about what your group and you yourself and your family are doing here. And of course, best of luck with continuing progress and all of these seminars, and even more projects that I know it sounds like you are one busy lady that and so thanks again. Well, there you have it, my conversation with Heather from the Farming for the Future program. done when my wife Skye and I visited the lovely North Island of New Zealand, the so-called home of Middle Earth. I hope that you found it as informative and inspiring as I did. If you want further information about the Farming for the Future program, please follow them on their Facebook webpage. And last but not least, I again want to acknowledge the artists of my theme music selections for this episode of Agroecology World. The song Once Again by the group Hang Massive, and the song Everyone Sleeps in the Light by Joaquin Cooter. Happy trails until we meet again at my next episode of Agroecology World. And please keep sharing it with your friends and associates who might be interested. I really appreciate your efforts in this regard so far, as the podcast is receiving a growing number of listeners, which is just wonderful.